Our argument is Warren versus United States. Mr. Faulkner.
Please, the court, counsel. This matter here involves a tort claims notice. Joseph Sayab was a Vietnam veteran, was treated at the Evansville VA clinic, and was treated in about March of 1998. And the allegations in the complaint are that he was suffering from esophageal cancer, which was not diagnosed, and therefore. About a year later, he was ultimately diagnosed at the Cincinnati VA clinic with esophageal cancer. A tort claims notice ensued, in which basically alleged that it was a failure to timely diagnose cancer of the esophagus, leading to decreased chance of favorable treatment of the claimant's cancer. And so the claim was denied. Mr. Sayab subsequently died, and suit was filed. And so the complaint is couched in terms of wrongful death. However, we also believe it states a claim for a decreased chance of survival or loss of chance, as we've I'll talk about later. But basically, the focus of the cases that I've cited and I've reviewed is that the focus is on the facts. Tell us what happened. Give us an opportunity to review the claim. Give us an opportunity to settle it, possibly, if it's appropriate. The cases tell us that we don't have to cite the legal theory. And so you'll have factual situations such as this where something happens, and then ultimately, if these events run their course, various causes of action might accrue. For example, you own a property adjoining the government, they spill some bad stuff on your property, your trees die, you know it's a tort claim, and then subsequent after that, then some livestock die. So that's the way we'd analyze it. And the practicalities of the situation are, before I get into the case law, the practicalities of the situation are is that it disserves the one of the primary objectives of the Tort Claims Act of efficiency to make a claimant go back to square one whenever a claimant has put the government on notice of facts leading up to, or of actually what happened, the factual basis for the claim. And one thing that seems to be running through these proceedings is that the government says that it did not know that a misdiagnosis of cancer might lead to death, which is not plausible in my view. Now, the primary case cited by the government, it was a case from this court, it was Fisk. And the Fisk case talks about the tort claim, the wrongful death cause of action or claim arising when as of death. In doing so, it analyzes Indiana law, which deals with that subject. But Indiana law has subsequently been modified by the Medical Malpractice Act, which does not create a new cause of action. However, it modifies the statute of limitations for a tort claims for wrongful death. It accrues on the date of the malpractice rather than death. So to that extent, we think the Fisk case is no longer applicable. However, we wouldn't necessarily have to reject the Fisk case because it says we look to state law to determine whether the plaintiff's claim is premature, but to federal law to determine whether the claim is stale. And that's 657 F second at 170. And so if the argument is that the claim, that the tort claims notice for the wrongful death prior to death is premature, then under state law it's not premature because it arose after, because that cause of action arises after or as of the malpractice occurring. And in fact, one thing that we would focus on as well is that the government's position seems to confuse claims which arise out of factual cases with causes of action, which are distinct legal concepts. And the other argument we had was that the claim does not specifically, or the complaint does not state a claim of only under wrongful death, but under the case of Cahoon versus Cummings, there is a doctrine that a survival claim which can arise where, for example, if the person had 100% chance of dying from cancer, if the misdiagnosis of the medical malpractice gave them only 2 years versus five, then there's a survival claim that survives under Cahoon. And under the notice pleading theories, we would urge that the complaint, even excluding the wrongful death, would survive. Now, the one case that I had cited to the court, in which seems to be the closest on point, is a federal district court case out of North Carolina. And I just want to quote something from that case because it basically has some very poignant language which supports our position and gets to the real heart of what went on here. To conclude that plaintiff must file a second claim would confuse claim with legal cause of action and would neglect the obvious purpose of 28 U.S.C. section 2675. That's at 541 F sub at 817. It says, go on to say that the defendant clearly had the opportunity occasioned by the defendant decedent's administrative claim to investigate and evaluate the incident out of which the lawsuit arose and to satisfy itself that the alleged personal injuries, if any, were the cause by the vaccine. In this case, it was an administration of vaccine. And they put it all together when they say the death is not the operative fact upon which liability rests. The claim required by Section 2675A is not the equivalent of a legal cause of action which the plaintiff's attorney may articulate at trial. So we think that the district court in that case got it right as it relates to the factual situation very similar to this. And the Fisk case, along with all the other cases, the general approach to these is to construe the Tort Claims Act in a manner, if it's consistent with its provisions, that discourage the government from playing the game of gotcha, which is what happened here. In fact, the government laid in wait for over a year after the lawsuit was filed until the 2 years had passed after Mr. Sayas' death. And then they say, oh, well, you didn't file a separate tort claims notice after he died, so you've waived that. And so you have no cause of action for wrongful death. And that does not appear to satisfy any of the stated purposes for the Tort Claims Act, that being efficiency and fairness. And so
the original notice of claim filed based on medical malpractice before the death occurred was responded to by the government, as I understand it, and with some requests for information, and those requests were basically ignored over the course of some many months, and so the file was closed and the claim was denied on that basis. Is that right?
That's what they've alleged. We would dispute that, but I don't think that's necessarily germane because
they
did, in fact.
You would dispute it. You did give them the information they requested?
To our knowledge, everything they requested.
What do you mean to your knowledge? Did they get the stuff or not?
We provided them everything they asked for.
So you're saying they're lying when they say you didn't respond.
Well, I'm not saying they're lying, but I'm saying...
Well, you must be. I mean, you either gave it to them or you didn't. They say you didn't, you'd say they did. You did.
Well, Your Honor, quite frankly, I'm relying on what former counsel did, and I'm told that that's the case, but I specifically did not handle the matter at that point.
You didn't investigate the issue. You don't know. In other words, you don't know.
No, right. I don't, Your Honor.
You know. Okay.
But I don't think it's necessarily germane to the issue.
No, I understand that, but you don't know. It's not what you're
saying. I think I'm in my rebuttal time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Faulkner. Mr. Hunter?
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jeffrey Hunter. I'm an assistant United States attorney representing the United States in this matter. Your Honors, the decision of the court below was correct and should be affirmed. This matter is case is controlled by the holding and logic in the Fisk case. And though it has an unfortunate result in this case, the logic in the Fisk case should be effective today.
Counsel, I'm a little unclear on the interplay, if any, between this requirement under the Federal Tort Claims Act and state statutes of limitation and repose and accrual rules and so forth. I don't see a real consistent theory or rule in the cases.
Yes. Your Honor, we think that the Fisk case has actually addressed all the issues raised by plaintiff in this matter and rejected them all. The fact is there was no claim in connection with the wrongful death that was presented to the VA because that claim hadn't arisen yet under the Indiana statutes. So how can you present a claim that has not yet accrued?
But Indiana state law, like the law of many other states in the medical malpractice area, has changed with regard to when a wrongful death that occurs in the context of medical malpractice accrues for purposes of a statute of limitations.
Well, it
repose.
Is. I'm sorry, Your Honor. It is the case that Indiana has adopted the loss of chance. But I submit that the Indiana cases make it clear that that really doesn't change the underlying claims. You have the medical malpractice claim, and you have the wrongful death claim. And the two claims are still separate under Indiana law. And that's addressed specifically in the Chamberlain case that we sent in as supplemental authority last week, which is a case cited by plaintiff in his reply brief that was at the appellate level but was reversed by the Indiana Supreme Court.
So your answer to my original question then is that the state law rules of claim accrual and statutes of limitation and so forth are relevant in this context or are not?
Yes, the accrual statutes are relevant. That's what the Fisk case says. And the statutes of limitation are not, and that's also what the Fisk case says.
Because what does it mean for a claim for wrongful death to arise before the person died? I was puzzled by that.
Well, I'm a little perplexed by that also, Your Honor, and that's what the Indiana courts have tended to indicate. We think upon analyzing the cases, the Fisk case is still controlling.
I mean, what if the statute of limitations is 2 years and the person dies in the third year? So his wrongful death claim would be barred? I don't understand.
That seems to be the logic of some of the Indiana cases. However, there are exceptions under the Indiana statute of limitations if the individuals could not have known of the cause of the death before the death itself, then the Indiana statute of limitations is also waived.
But what if you just don't know whether you're going to die?
Well,
what do you do?
I think in that case, there is the loss of chance theory that the individual could pursue under
the
Indiana
statute. Is that the idea that they really want you to, if it's a very serious illness that could shorten your life, they want you to pursue it as a loss of a chance case? Is that the idea?
They certainly give you that opportunity.
Well, they put a lot of pressure on you to do it, don't they?
Yes.
Say, if you die after the statute of limitations run, you're
yes, that's
out of luck.
That is true, Your Honor. As I said, unfortunately for the plaintiff in this case, the underlying logic of the Fisk case has not been affected by either the adoption of the loss of chance theory or by the Indiana
medical
malpractice.
Well, is it just logical or is it also sensible?
It's also sensible, Your Honor, in that there is some our efficiencies that can accrue to the United States by requiring the filing of the administrative tort claim notice when after the wrongful death has
why
accrued.
Is that? Why is
well, a number of the facts that would be relevant to the claim would only accrue or occur at the time in connection with the death. It's also very possible that the death might have occurred for some other reason rather than the malpractice. And if that's the case, it's a totally different fact situation and totally different exploration of the facts that needs to be done here. So that's contrary to the plaintiff's argument. There are efficiencies by pursuing the administrative tort claim notice and requiring that to be filed in connection with the wrongful death claim. Plaintiff also contends that somehow the Indiana Medical Malpractice Act has affected the logic of the Fisk case. And again, we think that the Chamberlain case makes it clear that the Indiana Medical Malpractice Act only applies to the procedure that's used in processing medical malpractice claims under Indiana law and procedure.
It did change the accrual rule, didn't it? I mean, they're still separate claims, a claim for medical malpractice and a wrongful death claim,
yeah,
but they all have to be processed through the Medical Malpractice Act.
Yes, but they're still conceptually separate claims.
But they all accrue on the date of the malpractice, not on the date of death under Indiana law, right?
Or
is that not true?
That may well be true, but under the Fisk case, the logic of the Fisk case is that you can't have the wrongful death claim until the date of the death.
Right, but that was based on the then state of the state law, which is that a wrongful death claim, even in the context of medical malpractice, accrues on the date of the death, and that is now changed, which gets back to my original question about whether we're really looking to state law for the federal rule or not.
Well, and the logic is, Your Honor, that how can the claim accrue under the wrongful death statute until the death occurs?
Because the Indiana legislature says so. And we have to accept that, and so have the Indiana courts. And so it's an absolute rule of repose for purposes of the operation of the statute of limitations in Indiana state court, even if the death occurs after the running of the statute of limitations.
But the operation of the Indiana statute of limitations does not affect the statute of limitations for federal purposes.
But does it affect the accrual date for Federal Tort Claims Acts? That's what I'm trying to get an answer to.
Your Honor, no, it does not under Fisk and the analysis set out in Fisk.
In other words, Fisk implies an exception to the general rule of following state law. Am I correct?
Yes, and in fact there's
That's
language.
That's the logic of Fisk,
yes.
In your view.
I believe there's language in Fisk that talks about the general rule for the accrual in the federal system is that the accrual of the wrongful death occurs on the date of the death. And in Fisk, they did not distinguish the cases.
There are other exceptions when the federal need does not permit following the state rule in the FTCA cases. Most of the time, though, those are pursuant to explicit statutory exceptions. Why don't we have an explicit statutory exception in this case, as we have in the others?
Well, again, logically, how can the claim accrue until the death occurs? And I think we could look to 2401 to say that, in essence, that is the statute that creates the federal rule.
I'm sorry, what is the federal statute?
The tort claim statute of limitations for presenting the administrative tort claim to the agency, which is, I believe, 2401B, if my memory is correct,
okay.
Which says that the claim has to be presented within 2 years of the accrual to the agency.
It sounds like you're changing your argument then from the beginning, which is to say that at the beginning you said that state law accrual rules are relevant in this context, and now you're saying they're not, that Fisk creates an exception, a federal rule that exists separate and apart from whatever the state accrual rules are. So is that your argument now?
Well, there, FIS does say that.
Right.
I believe. And so I think there is the federal accrual rule, and I would contend that the state accrual rule has not changed in light of the language in Cahoon and Chamberlain. And finally, Your Honors, briefly, as far as the allegation that there was an effort at a gotcha here, I can assure the court that, though it's not in the record, once the issue set out in FISC was brought to our attention and was determined that there was a viable claim, we took prompt action to bring that matter to the attention of the court. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hunter. Mr. Faulkner, is he have any time? 1 minute.
Real quickly, it's very clear that under Indiana's law and the Hopster versus Burgesson and Freddie versus Hedgecock cases I've cited in my brief, a wrongful death claim under which is caused by medical malpractice does accrue at the same time. Now, those of us in the plaintiff's bar don't like that rule very much, but it's what the courts tell us. It's what we have to live by. So, basically, as far as whether the analysis of Indiana law is important, this court thought it was important in the Fisk case because this court engaged in very thoughtful and extensive analysis of Indiana law as it was then. And so, however, that's changed, so we would urge that the result probably should change as well. As far as whether it's sensible or not, we don't think it's sensible that a government doctor should have to, after he's down in Florida and retired 30 years later after he's treated someone, face a potential medical malpractice claim, whereas an Indiana doctor who practices at one of the hospitals does not.
Would you be arguing that the Indiana accrual rule in medical malpractice should apply if the case was inverted? In other words, if the cause of action for wrongful death had accrued pursuant to Indiana state law at the time of the medical malpractice, but the statute of limitations had long since expired and the notice of claim was filed as of the date of the death.
Well, Your Honor, quite frankly, I see I'm out of time, but...
Do you see what I'm driving at?
Well, I think that there's... I mean, you can make an argument the other way, but I think the more compelling argument is the one I bring to the court today, but again, that's why we're here. Because this can be argued. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both parties. Next case.